It gives me great pleasure to welcome Sir Anthony Mason to the school. He tells me it's his first visit as a participant in the Law Department series of centennial lectures. Sir Anthony's career has been as varied as it's distinguished, and in his chosen field of equity and property law, I note that he still finds time to contribute to learned journals. Before his elevation to the bench, he served as law officer to the Commonwealth Government, and he's Chancellor of one university and Fellow of another. Sir Anthony's judicial career culminated in a period as Chief Justice of one of the most distinguished courts of the Commonwealth, and one which has, over a long period, made a substantial contribution to innovation in the common law world, and Sir Anthony has, of course, made his own mark on these developments. For us in the school, Sir Anthony's presence with us tonight is a tangible reminder of a long and valued relationship. When I myself studied for an LLM in this university, I think as many as 50% of the students, my fellow students, came from Commonwealth countries, and they were notably Australia, New Zealand and Canada. Indeed, I think I can see some of them here tonight. And they made an inestimable contribution to postgraduate studies in the university. Many of our alumni, some of whom we hope to welcome back on a flying visit to the school later in the week, are now in positions of influence in the public service of these countries, as well as in politics and private practice. But in recent years, retrenchment and funding difficulties everywhere have made this link harder to maintain. So we are therefore particularly grateful to the Shimizu Trust, which has funded this lecture tonight, for a very generous gift which will enable us in future years to fund one young scholar annually from a Pacific Rim country for postgraduate studies here at the school. And although that seems a drop in the ocean, at least it is something nice that to maintain our link. A further reason why we were so glad to be able to include this particular lecture in our series concerns its subject matter, because this department has made a steady and serious contribution to the study of Commonwealth public law. I actually suspect that the constitutions of some smaller territories, including that of Mauritius, for I know that one for certain, may actually have been drafted in this building by Professor Stanley de Smith. And before that, we had Sir Ivor Jennings, who was influential in the independence of Sri Lanka on the staff of the school. So I'm happy to be able to show that this tradition is still alive. Students also come here from all around the world to learn about human rights from my colleague, Professor Rosalind Higgins, whom I see in the audience, and Professor Lee still teaches comparative constitutional law in the LLM. Sir Anthony, I think you can see from this audience that your lecture has been most eagerly awaited, so I shall not detain the audience any longer, but ask you to speak.
Professor Harlow, ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be here and to be invited to speak. I must say, I've always associated the LSE with some of the more radical lawyers who have troubled me in the High Court of Australia, representing public interest advocacy groups. That's the one connection so far that I've had with the LSE. So I'm delighted to meet you all on a less adversarial basis. Now, what I propose to say is largely based on my experience in Australia, but I have endeavoured to relate that experience, as far as I can, to similar problems and questions and developments which are taking place in the United Kingdom. The role of the courts in the framework of government, the way in which they administer the law, is in the process of evolutionary change, both in the United Kingdom and Australia. The forces driving that process of evolutionary change in both countries are, I think, broadly similar, though in the United Kingdom they are directly related to its membership of the European Economic Community and its subjection to the legal regime which that membership entails. The courts in the United Kingdom and Australia have not advanced as far along this path of evolutionary change as have courts in other modern democracies. The surface explanation for that is that neither country has adopted a Bill of Rights, either entrenched in a constitution or statute-based. Lying behind that explanation, a belief in majoritarian democracy and Professor A.V. Dicey's legal theory of parliamentary sovereignty, which may well have had a longer lasting and greater impact in the United Kingdom and Australia than it has had elsewhere. The theory of parliamentary sovereignty is often associated with the notion of majoritarian government. Parliamentary sovereignty, like majoritarian government, makes no allowance for the apprehension of the tyranny of the majority and the need to guard against it by entrenching fundamental guarantees. Indeed, the theory is antagonistic to the existence of such guarantees because they would and do operate as a limitation on the legislative power of Parliament. And that is why Professor Dicey placed such emphasis on common law protection of individual rights, and it is why Sir Robin Cook, the President of the New Zealand Court of Appeal, has suggested that some common law rights may go so deep that even Parliament cannot be accepted by the courts to have destroyed them, a view which Lord Reid had firmly rejected in 1974. It is sometimes said that the theory of parliamentary sovereignty is at odds with judicial review, that is, judicial review in the American sense of that term, reviewing statutes for invalidity. But of course that is not the case in federations such as Australia, Canada and the United States, where legislative supremacy has been accepted, at least in Australia and Canada. The doctrine has coexisted with the exercise by the courts of jurisdiction by way of judicial review in the American sense of that expression. In other words, the legislature is supreme within the limits of the powers assigned to it by the Constitution. As a matter of constitutional and legal theory, the same approach can be taken to the inclusion in a constitution of guarantees of fundamental rights. They operate merely to limit the boundaries within which the legislature is supreme. But there was no disposition in the United Kingdom or Australia to encourage that approach, and that was due to the doctrine of legalism, as well as a belief in the virtues of majoritarian democracy. Although it would be a mistake to describe parliamentary sovereignty as the progenitor of legalism, the two are connected. Acceptance of the supremacy of Parliament went hand in hand with strong judicial deference to the will of Parliament, drawing a distinction between law and politics and law and policy, so that law reform was a matter for Parliament and the courts gave emphasis to matters of form rather than matters of substance. This demarcation of the relationship of the judiciary with the legislative and executive branches of government not only elevated the role of Parliament and respected the role of the executive, but also restricted the function of the courts and seemingly insulated them from involvement in controversy arising from judicial determination of political and policy issues. So it was a demarcation that appeared to offer some advantages to the judges. At the same time, the demarcation was reinforced by strict adherence to the doctrine of precedent and stare decisis, thereby minimising the lawmaking function of the judges. Also reinforcing the demarcation was the detailed style of legislative drafting, which left the courts with less creative role to play in the interpretation of statutes. Notwithstanding that Australia has a written constitution which confers limited powers on the federal parliament and impliedly authorises the courts to declare statutes invalid for excess of constitutional power, the doctrines of legalism, like the theory of parliamentary sovereignty, have flourished in Australia as strongly as they have in the United Kingdom. Sir Owen Dixon's statement, "There is no other safe guide to judicial decision in great conflicts than a strict and complete legalism," was widely accepted and respected in Australia. Moreover, the statement was read more narrowly than was justified in the light of other statements made by Sir Owen Dixon concerning judicial method. However, elsewhere in continental Europe and the United States, apprehensions about the tyranny of the majority resulted in the adoption of constitutions which incorporated guarantees of individual rights. These examples were supported by the ringing endorsement by the Supreme Court of the United States of fundamental rights in such a way as to make fundamental rights a powerful instrument of protection of oppressed minority groups and individuals, and brought it to the very centre of the international stage. Enforcement of fundamental rights came to be seen internationally as a bulwark protecting minority groups and those who were the victims of oppression and discrimination. Hence, the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and regional conventions, of which the European Convention on Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms is a notable example. The very existence of fundamental rights provisions, whether contained in international conventions or constitutions, challenges the primacy of the concept of majoritarian democracy and the legal theory of unqualified parliamentary sovereignty. More than that, the interpretation of fundamental rights provisions involves an approach to interpretation radically different from that traditionally applied in the United Kingdom and Australia. And changing constitutional and political arrangements, particularly in Europe, have provided a new perspective on parliamentary sovereignty. The European Community Act of 1972 of the United Kingdom, as you know, provided that statutes already enacted and those to be enacted thereafter would take effect subject to community law. One aspect of parliamentary sovereignty is that a legislature cannot fetter its future capacity to repeal by later statute a statute that it has enacted earlier. That proposition has no application when a constitution contains a manner and form provision for legislation of a particular kind, or authorises the legislature to enact manner and form requirements for such legislation. But can a parliament, in the absence of such a constitutional requirement or authority, enact a law as a paramount law so that it is not liable to repeal by the ordinary lawmaking processes of the parliament? According to the legal theory of parliamentary sovereignty, the answer must be no. However, it has been argued that a parliament can, by resort to the manner and form prescription, entrench a statute so that it can be repealed only by a statute which conforms to that prescription. It has been suggested that the House of Lords in factotum gave some support to this notion. There, interlocutory injunctions against the Crown were upheld pending the determination of references to the European Court. Lord Bridge said it was the duty of a United Kingdom court to override any rule of national law found to be in conflict with a directly enforceable rule of community law. That principle was endorsed very recently in the Queen and the Employment Secretary ex parte the Equal Opportunity Commission. However, the principle may proceed simply on the footing that in the absence of an expression of specific intention to repeal pro tanto, a subsequent statute will be ineffective to achieve that purpose. In other words, Section 2 may be read as a direction that any statutory provision, prima facie compatible with community law, shall not operate in derogation of community law unless the statute is expressed to operate in breach of the United Kingdom's community treaty obligations, contrary to Section 2. What the courts would do in the face of an express or specific intention to repeal is a fascinating question which may never arise. It has been suggested that the courts would give effect to such a statute. Meantime, there is a strong case for simply treating the European Communities Act as constituting a higher constitutional law which must be obeyed unless it is expressly set aside by a subsequent statute. It may be of some significance that a statutory provision which is incompatible with community law is inoperative rather than invalid. The concept of inoperative statutes has been used in Canadian and Australian law, I think to good effect. Australia is not confronted presently with the problem of reconciling parliamentary sovereignty with the political necessity of recognising a higher law other than the Australian Constitution. But at an earlier time, Australia had the problem that although its constitution was in substance approved by the Australian people, it nevertheless was a statute enacted by the British Parliament and was subject to amendment by it. Indeed, when the United Kingdom Parliament finally renounced its sovereignty in respect of Australia in 1986 by the Australia Act 1986, it purported to exercise its legislative power in relation to Australia. Since then, the view has been expressed by the High Court of Australia in a series of cases, Nationwide News and Wills, Australian Capital Television and the Commonwealth, Theophanous and Herald and Weekly Times, and Stevens and Western Australian newspapers, that the Constitution brought into existence a system of representative government for Australia in which the elected representatives exercise legislative power on behalf of the Australian people. Indeed, it has been said that ultimate sovereignty resides in the Australian people and that members of Parliament and ministers of state exercise their legislative and executive powers as representatives of the people. From these propositions, other conclusions have been drawn. First, that there is to be implied from the structure of the Constitution, providing as it does for the institution of representative government or democracy, a freedom of communication with respect to political discussion, using that term in a wide sense so as to include matters of public affairs. Such an implication is to be made as a matter of necessity on the footing that freedom of communication with respect to political discussion is indispensable to the efficacious working of the system of government or democracy for which the Constitution itself provides. The implication gains some direct support from particular provisions of the Constitution, providing for the election by the people of the members of the two Houses of Parliament. But in essence, in the reasons of those who constituted the majority, the implication was derived from the structure of the Constitution and what was contemplated by the Constitution as a system of government. In Canada, prior to the adoption of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the Supreme Court of Canada had recognised an implied freedom of expression, seemingly limited to political discussion, although that perhaps may not be entirely beyond doubt. And that implication was similarly based in the provisions made by the British North America Act of 1867 for representative government in Canada. Neither in Australia nor Canada was the implication made on the footing that the freedom of communication or expression was a fundamental right. The implication sprang from the very nature of the system of government for which the two constitutions provided. Two aspects of the implied freedom of communication distill from the Australian Constitution should be noted. It is, as I've said, to be distinguished from freedom of expression as a fundamental right. The Australian implication is limited to freedom of political discussion, in the wide sense of that term, extending to discussion of public affairs as an indispensable element in ensuring the efficacious working of representative democracy and government. The Australian implication is negative in character, being a restriction on the exercise of legislative and executive power, rather than a source of positive rights. Whether the Constitution would also support an implication of freedom of association and freedom of movement based on the need to protect representative government as provided for in the Constitution is not a matter that has yet arisen for consideration. But as the basis of the implication would seem to be the same, it might well be that such implications would be made. The implication of freedom of communication is not inconsistent with parliamentary supremacy once it is appreciated that parliamentary supremacy is necessarily subject to and controlled by the Constitution itself. In this respect, the parallel between Australia and the United Kingdom cannot be precise. But perhaps the time will come in the United Kingdom when recognition of the doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty must accommodate itself to the political and constitutional arrangements which flow from entry into the European Economic Community and all that that incidentally entails. Public law legal doctrine should accurately reflect or give effect to political and constitutional arrangements. Indeed, not only is it correct to regard the doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty as being subject to and controlled by relevant paramount constitutional arrangements, it is also necessary to take account of the fact that subject to the United Kingdom's membership of the European Economic Community, behind the legal sovereignty of Parliament lies the political sovereignty of the people. The existence of that political sovereignty supports the view that the legislative powers of Parliament are to be exercised in the interests of the people. I do not suggest by that that legislative powers are fiduciary powers and enforceable as such. What I do say is that once you recognise that the broad purpose underlying the grant of legislative powers is that they are to be exercised in the interests of the people, then in Australia the implication of freedom of communication is to be seen not so much as a restriction on the exercise of power, though that is how it does operate, but as an essential feature of our constitutional arrangements and one which enhances the quality of democratic government. In other words, I would reject the shallow notion that our constitutional arrangements simply contemplate the grant to our elected representatives of an unlimited mandate to govern on the footing that the only effective interest of the governed is to vote for those representatives at elections. Our constitutional arrangements are more subtle and sophisticated than that. They envisage an effective system of democratic government in which powers are exercised in the interests of the people. And our conception of modern democratic government extends beyond simple majoritarianism to respect for fundamental rights and the dignity of the individual. The time-honoured statement that it is the role of a constitutional court to interpret the Constitution tells us very little about the function of such a court. Just as in the United Kingdom, where the courts have played a significant part in shaping the existing constitutional arrangements. So in other countries, the courts have played such a part in spelling out the details of the arrangements for which written constitutions provide. In formulating those principles, the courts in this country, like the courts in Australia and elsewhere, must take as their foundation the concept of a modern representative system of government, the form of which is defined by the various rules which make up the relevant body of constitutional law. So, subject to making due allowance for the fact that the terms of a written constitution constrain the powers of the various arms of government, there is an underlying similarity between the role of the courts in relation to written and unwritten constitutions. Naturally, with an unwritten constitution, the absence of express limitations or restraints on the exercise of legislative powers tends to encourage greater judicial deference to the will of the legislature than is usually to be observed in jurisdictions where there is a written constitution. Striking down statutes for invalidity or incompatibility gives the judicial vision of the relationship between the judiciary and the legislature a somewhat different focus. Even so, the experience in the United States, Canada, and Australia provides many illustrations of qualified judicial deference to the will and judgment of the legislature. In determining whether legislation is within constitutional power or consistent with constitutional prohibitions and guarantees, courts, even the Supreme Court of the United States, allow a margin of appreciation for legislative judgment when appropriate. Qualified judicial deference continues to serve several beneficial purposes. Although modern constitutional arrangements do not reflect an absolute separation of powers, and the classification of powers is incapable of precise definition so as to yield clear-cut legal principles, judicial deference based on the separation of powers as a broad guideline ensures that the organs of government cleave to the substance of their traditional functions, and yet allows for necessary changes in the way they are performed. In formulating relevant legal principles, there is no reason why the court should be confined to the adoption of principles which are necessary for the effective working of our system of representative democratic government. Their role extends to the adoption of principles which enhance the working of that system. So in Coco against the Queen, the High Court of Australia pointed out that curial insistence on a clear expression of an unmistakable and unambiguous intention to abrogate or curtail a fundamental right or freedom will enhance the parliamentary process by securing a greater measure of attention on the part of the legislators to the impact of legislative proposals on fundamental rights. In that case, the court refused, in the absence of statutory authority, clearly so expressed, to spell out from a statute authorising the use of listening devices, under certain conditions, authority to enter on private premises for the purpose of installing such a device. Such an entry would, in the absence of statutory authority, have amounted to tortious conduct. Indeed, the principle enunciated by the court was expressed to have equal application to statutory authority to engage in tortious conduct, that is, to statutory abrogation or curtailment of common law rights, the right in that case being the right to possession of one's land free from unauthorised trespass. Earlier in England, in Morris and Beardmore, where a similar view was taken, Lord Scarman referred to the importance attached by the common law to the privacy of the home. The extension of the principle to abrogation or curtailment of fundamental rights and freedoms is significant in that it indicates that the courts will protect rights and interests other than those hitherto protected by the common law. The rationale for this presumption against the abrogation or curtailment of fundamental rights is the improbability that the legislature would intend such a result without expressing its intention with unmistakable clarity. The approach adopted in Australia is very similar to that adopted in the United Kingdom, although there is a slight difference. In COCO, the joint judgment referred to the view expressed by Lord Brown Wilkinson that the presence of general words in a statute is insufficient to authorise interference with basic immunities, which are the foundation of our freedom, and that to constitute such authorisation, express words are necessary. In essence, then, specific words are necessary, though in Australia we have not excluded the possibility that in some circumstances an intention to abrogate or curtail might be implied to prevent a statutory provision from becoming meaningless or inoperative, very exceptional as that case might be. The insistence in this country on the necessity for express or specific words is consistent with the apparent insistence of express words in any statute intended to depart from the provisions of community law in breach of the United Kingdom's community treaty obligations. The requirement for express words, as in COCO, serves the additional purpose of enhancing the parliamentary or political process. The adoption of a presumptive rule of construction in relation to common law rights or interests protected by the common law calls for the careful identification of those rights and interests. Otherwise, there may be a tendency to assume that rights and interests now thought worthy of attention are identical with those which have been protected by the common law. Of course, the common law did protect some rights which are now regarded as fundamental. However, the common law did not protect other rights which are now regarded as fundamental, and some of the rights and interests which were formerly protected by the common law might be regarded as less worthy of protection today. So we might be better advised to think of applying the presumptive rule of construction to generally accepted fundamental rights, recognising that there will be a large element in common between common law rights and fundamental rights. At the same time, we need to recognise that some rights and interests which we regard as fundamental have been moulded by the common law, the doctrine of natural justice or procedural fairness, and the right to a fair trial. Indeed, the courts in developing the body of modern administrative law have drawn heavily on the common law concept of natural justice and procedural fairness. In so doing, the courts have injected a powerful element of fairness into administrative decision making by extending the reach of fundamental doctrine and values of the common law. In the same way, in the last decade, many of the decisions of the High Court of Australia, including those affirming the jurisdiction of the courts to stay criminal proceedings for abuse of process, an approach which has not been adopted in England, and in particular the decision in Dietrich against the Queen, which recognised the jurisdiction to stay or postpone a trial where an indigent accused person is charged with a serious offence through no fault on his part, is unable to obtain legal representation, have drawn on the related common law concept of a fair trial. Dietrich against the Queen is an interesting example of what I have been saying. Essentially, the proposition for which the decision stands is based on the common law right to a fair trial. But the approach taken by the court, as Justice McHugh and I noted in our joint judgment, is similar to that for which Article 14.3d of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights provides, at least when viewed in the light of decisions on a somewhat similar provision in the European Convention on Human Rights. In Australia, it has not been necessary for us to decide whether, as Sir Robin Cook has suggested, there are some rights so deeply embedded in the common law as to be incapable of legislative destruction. Indeed, in 1988, the High Court of Australia expressly left that question open. In one respect, that question has slightly less importance for us, at least in the context of the trial. That is because Chapter 3 of the Australian Constitution entrenches the exercise of federal judicial power in the courts there mentioned. Chapter 3 therefore protects the exercise of federal judicial power against legislative interference. To the extent to which the decisions affirming the exercise of inherent jurisdiction to stay or postpone criminal proceedings fall within Chapter 3, they would be immune from legislative interference. Lim and the Minister for Immigration is an interesting recent example of the protection given by Chapter 3. In that case, the court declared invalid Section 54R of the Migration Act 1958. The section provided a court is not to order the release from custody of a designated person. The statutory provisions were framed in such a way that a designated person would almost certainly be an illegal immigrant, one of the so-called boat people. A majority of the court said, in terms, Section 54R is a direction by the Parliament to the courts as to the manner in which they are to exercise their jurisdiction. It is one thing for the Parliament to grant or withhold jurisdiction. It is quite a different thing for the Parliament to direct the courts as to the manner and outcome of the exercise of their jurisdiction. Would the courts in England return a similar answer to that question, despite the absence of a written constitution? From all the advantage of remoteness on the other side of the globe, I would be tempted to answer that question in the affirmative. As a result of some recent decisions, there has been some speculation that the Australian Constitution might become a source of implied fundamental rights. Existing interpretations of the few express guarantees of rights in the Constitution lend little support to that speculation. However, the most recent case, Street and the Queensland Bar Association, gave a liberal interpretation to Section 117, which provides that an out-of-state resident shall not be subject to any disability or discrimination in any other state which does not apply to an in-state resident. That decision, it has been suggested, could possibly lead to the taking of a fresh approach to other express guarantees. On the other hand, one of the court's most notable recent decisions, Cole and Whitfield, on Section 92, which guarantees freedom of interstate trade, did not treat that provision as amounting to a fundamental right. The course of judicial reasoning, which led to the implication of freedom of communication in the Australian Constitution in the cases to which I referred earlier, likewise gives no support to the speculation. As I pointed out, the implication was based simply on the structure of the Constitution in providing for representative government, and it was limited to discussion of political matters. It did not extend to freedom of expression generally. And the later case, Theophanus, which came down in favour of a modified public figure defence in defamation, based on New York Times and Sullivan, confines public figure defence to public officials. To make out that defence in Australia, as distinct from the United States, The publisher must establish that it was unaware of the falsity of the imputation, that it did not publish recklessly, that is, not caring whether the publication was true or false, and that the publication was reasonable in the circumstances. In determining whether the publication was reasonable, regard will be had to whether any attempt was made to check the accuracy of the imputation and whether it was feasible to do so. We considered that these requirements would set an appropriate balance between vindication of reputation and freedom of communication. In passing, I note that the considerations favouring freedom of expression, which were influential in Theophanus, were also influential in Derbyshire County Council and Times newspapers. Though in Derbyshire they led to the conclusion that the local authority could not sue in libel, whereas individual councillors could do so in accordance with a common law of defamation, which presumably was unaffected by the considerations which destroyed a cause of action on the part of the authority. The difference may be explained by our journey down a different constitutional path. One suggested avenue for the importation of implied rights into the Australian Constitution is that the Constitution picks up and incorporates common law rights. So far, that suggestion finds no support in the judicial decisions. And for my part, I doubt that it finds adequate support in Sir Owen Dixon's view that in Australia, the common law being an antecedent system of law in which the Constitution operates, is an ultimate constitutional foundation. His Honour observed, constitutional questions should be considered and resolved in the context of the whole law, of which the common law forms not the least essential part. In conformity with that statement, the High Court recently stated that the interpretation of the Australian Constitution is necessarily influenced by the fact that its provisions are framed in the language of the English common law and are to be read in the light of the common law's history. But that does not necessarily mean that the written constitution incorporates the common law as part of its terms, though it has been suggested that just as statutes must be read in the absence of a clear expression of intention to the contrary, so as not to infringe fundamental common law liberties, so the Constitution must be read as not permitting any such infringement. Nor does it necessarily mean that the Constitution must be read in the light of the common law, or the common law as it stood in 1900 when the Constitution was enacted. Another suggested and perhaps more promising avenue for the importation of terms into the Constitution is via assumptions which underlie the Constitution. In Leith and the Commonwealth, three justices detected in the Constitution the common law doctrine of legal equality, that doctrine being in part at least a manifestation of Professor Dicey's concept of the rule of law. In Leith, that approach was invoked to support the invalidation of a federal law, the practical effect of which was to impose different minimum prison terms on offenders according to the state in which the offender was tried. That difference arising by virtue of differences between the laws of the states which were applicable by virtue of the federal law. In the result, the court by majority upheld the validity of the federal law. Leith seems to be a first instalment rather than a final chapter. It may be that Leith, to the extent if at all, that it is a harbinger of things to come, has more to say about the elements of the rule of law and equal treatment in that context than about fundamental rights generally. At the same time, the Leith judgments to which I have referred provide some support for those who say that a constitution is to be interpreted in the light of the fundamental doctrines on which it is structured, and one might add, in the light of the principal objects which it seeks to serve. Just as the courts can protect common law rights by applying presumptive rules of construction, so they can protect fundamental rights, even in the absence of constitutional entrenchment or statutory backing. Although Australia and the United Kingdom have no Bill of Rights, they have acceded to international instruments which call for the recognition of fundamental rights. The United Kingdom, having acceded to the European Convention, has not incorporated it into domestic law while respecting the jurisdiction of the European Court of Human Rights. Australia has acceded to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Optional Protocol, thereby accepting the jurisdiction of the Human Rights Committee, although Australia has not incorporated the provisions of the Covenant. Nor has Australia enacted general legislation enabling all decisions of that committee to be enforced in accordance with Australian law. Accordingly, Australian courts stand in an anomalous and unsatisfactory position. That position is not unlike that of United Kingdom courts in relation to decisions of the European Court of Human Rights. In effect, the decisions of national courts, even of the highest national courts, are liable to be displaced by reference to the decisions of an international court or tribunal. Behind the anomaly lies the settled principle that the provisions of an international treaty or convention acceded to by the executive government form no part of our municipal law unless they are incorporated by legislation. Not that the international rule is without significance for domestic purposes. Where a statute or subordinate legislation is ambiguous, the court should favour that construction with a court which accords with the nation's treaty obligations, at least when the treaty antedates the statute or other instrument. More than that, the treaty or international convention may play a part in the development of the common law. In Australia, we have taken the view that the provisions of such a convention to which Australia is a party, especially a convention which declares universal fundamental rights, may be used as a legitimate guide in developing the common law. However, we stated that the court should only act in this way with circumspection, lest judicial development of the common law should be seen as a backdoor means of incorporating an unincorporated convention into Australian domestic law. In Minister for Immigration and Ethnic Affairs and TO, which was decided about 3 months ago, that approach led us to the conclusion that Article 3 of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, to which Australia had acceded, but which had not been incorporated into Australian law, gave rise to a legitimate expectation that administrative decision makers would act in conformity with the Convention and treat the best interests of the child as a primary consideration, as required by Article 3. That decision and the principle on which it rested generated controversy. The Australian government responded by issuing a statement that entry into an international treaty is not a reason for raising an expectation that government decision makers will act in accordance with an unincorporated treaty. The government also indicated that it would enact legislation dealing with the matter. The government statement was in turn challenged by those who asserted that the government was deserting its international obligations. Commentators pointed out that although the provisions of the convention had not been incorporated into domestic law, the Attorney General, pursuant to Section 47 of the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission Act, of the Commonwealth, declared the convention to be an international instrument relating to human rights and freedoms for the purposes of that act. That declaration thereby attracted the powers of the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission to ensure that there was no non-compliance with certain obligations under the convention. Disconformity between domestic law and the law applied by international courts and tribunals is becoming a problem. That is because the law applied by international courts and tribunals regulates acts and transactions which are not in themselves international in character. And the United Kingdom and Australia, as good international citizens, respect and apply the decisions of those courts and tribunals. Moreover, there are no signs that the internationalisation and globalisation of law, to use two forbidding terms, are coming to an end. The disconformity not only has the capacity to generate conflicting decisions, but also tends to put even the highest national court in a subordinate position, exercising what may prove to be, in a particular case, an irrelevant jurisdiction. There is a need to bring domestic law into line with a nation's international obligations. I conclude by saying that the legal doctrine of legislative supremacy is no longer as convincing as it once was. That is because the doctrine fails to account for and to take account of various developments which are having an impact upon our constitutional and political arrangements. It is therefore the continuing responsibility of the courts to maintain and develop principles of public law which will protect and enhance our conception of modern democratic government, in which fundamental rights and the dignity of the individual are respected.
Very much an issue in this country. I think everybody in your